Hello.
Hello and welcome to Should I Love This Comic? Welcome to our newest episode of Should I Love This Comic. My name is Damien Drouet-Whiter, and with me I have...
My name is Irrigail Drouet-Whiter.
And today we're here to talk about another issue. We're continuing to work our way through the Marvel Comics cover dated November 1986, celebrating the 25th anniversary of Marvel Comics. And you remember why it's the 25th anniversary of Marvel Comics in 1986?
Because
they started in 1939, obviously.
Yes.
Which was more than 25 years before. But anyway, that's all very confusing. No, it's because they're celebrating. It's the 25th anniversary of the Fantastic Four, which is the start of Marvel Comics, even though the company existed before. Okay. And actually, their very first comic, Marvel Comics number one, that was published way, way back in the... I think it was either 1939 or 1940. Mm. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But that featured a character who's featured in the comic we're covering today, because we are covering Alpha Flight number 40. It was written by Bill Mantlo, penciled by Dave Ross, inked by Wells Portasio, lettered by Jim Novak, coloured by Bob Sharon, and edited by Carl Potts. And the covers by June Brickman, Kevin Nolan, and George Roussos. Lots of names there.
Mm-hmm.
But any regular listener, and obviously you, darling, will be aware that we've already covered a lot of these creators. Bill Mantlo was the creator of Cloak and Dagger, so he was involved. He wrote the Spider-Man issue that we covered previously, quite a while ago.
Right.
The first one with Cloak and Dagger in it.
Yeah.
And Black Cat and stuff. We haven't come across Dave Ross or Wells Portasio yet, but Jim Novak also lettered comics that we've covered previously. Bob Sharon has coloured them before. We've got a new editor, though, and we have been talking a lot about what was going on editorially behind the scenes in Marvel in 1986. That's been a lot of our coverage, what I keep calling the passion of Jim Shooter, because we're not at his death and resurrection until 1987 and beyond. You know, the end of Jim Shooter's reign as editor-in-chief at Marvel has been an influence on a lot of the stories that we've covered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have been fired, so there's been a new person coming in doing something really quickly. There's been a lot of changeover.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this issue is one where, really, Jim Shooter being fired... No. Jim Shooter kind of going crazy doesn't affect this story very much.
Mm.
We're actually at the end of a long storyline that's completely unaffected by all the behind-the-scenes kerfuffle. And actually, Alpha Flight doesn't get affected until after he's gone, when the new editor-in-chief changes something that he's approved, which hasn't come up yet, starts the next issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is one of the stories that isn't affected by that. It's got quite a stable team. At this point, I think Dave Ross has been the penciler for about 5 issues.
Mm.
Wells Portasio has only been on the book for, I think, 3 or 4 issues, but it's the beginning of a long run. He's on till issue 50, I think. I think Dave Ross is on to about issue 45 or 46.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a relatively long run for both of them. And Bill Mantlo stays on till about issue 64, I think it is.
Right.
Something like that. So, you know, this is the middle of a long run. Nobody's been fired recently or is just about to get fired.
Okay.
Who's working on the book.
Good.
No storylines have been changed. However, I did find a very interesting quote from Carl Potts, who was the editor. So I'm trying to look into what's going on behind the scenes. And he actually, in an interview that he did with comicbookhistorians.com,
mm-hmm.
talks a little bit about the end of the Jim Shooter era and his involvement in basically Jim Shooter getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a lot before about how Jim Shooter started micromanaging the artists and writers and editors. And that's really what this is about. So this is a quote directly from Carl Potts. He said, "Well, that's something a lot of us that lived through that era have never been able to quite figure out. What flipped the switch in Jim's mind," said Jim Shooter, because he used to brag about how he'd assembled the greatest roster of editors in the history of comics. And then at some point, within a short amount of time, he went on with this attitude that we were all a bunch of clueless idiots that needed to be led by the hand by him, the master. And that caused just, you know, all kinds of consternation. And a lot of it was aggravated by the two Secret Wars series. We've talked about them before, haven't we?
Yeah.
And then it really started with the Secret Wars thing, because Jim decided this was such an important thing that only one person could possibly write it and then essentially edited it. And that was him. And the policy that he'd had in place up until that time was that, as I mentioned earlier, that he encouraged editors to do freelance work. He felt it was good to keep them experienced on both sides of the desk, but not on their own titles. Well, you couldn't write or do any of the art on a book that you edited. You also couldn't write or do the art on a book edited by someone who you supervised. So if you were the line, you know, if you're a group editor, you can't be employed by an editor who you do the reviews for.
Sure.
So when I became executive editor, I oversaw a third of the editorial department, and I could not do creative work for any of those people because I was in charge of their reviews. I oversaw them, except the only person that was immune to Shooter's rule was Shooter. And so when he was writing as editor-in-chief, ideally what would have happened if he was following his own rules, the publisher, Mike Hobson, would have been the editor on those. But when one of the line editors had to edit Secret Wars or any of his other titles, something like that, he could, and he often did, override them. He would totally blow deadlines left and right and cause total chaos in that regard. He insisted that every title in the Marvel Universe do some sort of crossover with Secret Wars, and all of those crossovers had to be coordinated and approved by him. And since he was so hands-on with this thing, very few people were ever pleased with him with what they were doing, and they keep being revised. As an example, on the Hulk, well, since it was also so late, Secret Wars was very late because the writer started out late and the writer was Shooter, and the editor couldn't really threaten to fire Shooter because Shooter was his boss. It made no sense. So I liked having all my books done as close to the ideal schedule as possible. I liked having about 5 different issues in various stages of production at the same time. The one that was about to go out the door was having the final production work done on it. The issue before that was being coloured, the issue before that was being inked, the one before that was being pencilled, the one before that was being scripted, etc. And that way, if somebody ever did have a problem, they got hurt or injured or family issues or whatever, I could often have some wiggle room to keep the creative crew and the continuity of the book going. But if you start out late, there's no wiggle room. And so I had a couple of issues of Hulk that were already past where the Secret Wars crossover was going to be when Jim finally got around to saying, you've got to do a crossover. So we had to carve out a Secret Wars crossover book out of a book that was already done. And we did that, and Mignola was penciling the Hulk for me at the time. And of course Shooter had to approve those. And I got Xeroxes back from Shooter of Mike's stuff that had these incredibly harsh, insulting notes all over. He hated Mignola's work, he despised it. I told my assistant, all right, we're going to have to make some changes here. Do not send Mike copies with Shooter's notes on them. Send him the blank ones and then I'll send my notes on what to change. And the assistant accidentally put the wrong ones in. And whenever I run into Mike now, we still often converse about his reaction when he opened those pages up and saw Shooter's comments. It was not pleasant. So basically he's telling a story there of one of his artists was doing some work and he wrote really rude comments about the work. And it ended up going back to the artist, and it's the kind of thing that could harm his kind of relationship with the artist who's working with. And then there's another one. There was this thing that happened about a month or so before Shooter was let go that ended up being called the Palace Revolt or Storming the Bastille, where a bunch of us went in to really have it out with Shooter. And in the middle of that, someone decided that Hobson should witness this. So they came down. They brought him down and he saw what was going on in Shooter's office when we were going back and forth about how he was handling the company and the personnel. And I think that made an impression on Hobson too, that Shooter basically lost the confidence of the rank and file of all the editorial staff, or most of them. So there's two things there that I think are quite interesting. You see this, it's this micromanaging, but it's micromanaging people who he's making late by being late himself.
Right.
Because he's got lots going on, and we talked about that with the Spider-Man ones, that, you know, Tom DeFalco was late because he was the second in command to Jim Shooter, and Jim Shooter sent him to London and sent him to Amsterdam, and he'd fall behind. And the same thing's happening here. He's making things late. People are having to do changes at the last minute, and he's doing it in a way that insults the creators and make them want to late. And obviously one of the things that's interesting about this is the artist he's referring to, Karl Potts is referring to there, is Mike Mignola, who's a really popular artist. He's actually the guy who created Hellboy, which you will have heard of because it's been two movies.
A film,
yeah.
Two films, even.
Two different films, yeah, with different stars. Yeah, there was quite a recent one that starred the guy out of Stranger Things, which I haven't actually seen that one.
Oh, okay.
You know, the one who, the guy who was the policeman. He played Hellboy in the more recent one. Yeah.
Okay.
But he went on to create Hellboy, which obviously is one of the most popular and successful comic creators of all time. And his early work obviously is not as good as the stuff he did on Hellboy, but it's got, it's good enough. And it's got, like, possibilities for the future. And Shooter's just like, no, this is shit. And he's writing comments all over it. You know, and this guy is so good, he did actually have a run on Alpha Flight, and he drew the images in the corner box there.
Okay.
When he was in charge of Alpha Flight. So, you know, he worked with Karl Potts, and he ends up leaving Marvel to go to DC. About the same time that this is going on, Mike Mignola goes over to DC. And part of that will be because of all this stuff. And they're losing people who will be greats of the future. Now, in fairness, Mike Mignola came back to Marvel, and now he only works on his own stuff. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that happened. So, you know, it was going on a lot, and I think that's quite interesting. So it didn't... There's nothing in this story that happens because of this fallout.
Right.
You know, at no point in this story does Jim Shooter go, you must change the ending, they must get married. You know, that was the story that was created by the writer.
Okay.
In... You know, it was approved by his editor and then approved by the editor-in-chief. But it, this isn't one of those ones where, you know, there was a bomb scare and they had to change the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Like with The Web of Spider-Man or something. This one is the story that Bill Mantlo wants to tell.
Sure.
But even so, there's stuff going on behind the scenes with some of these people that is affecting the creators' relationships with the editors that's making their job harder, which I think is interesting to know. You know, even though this one is less affected by that in the whole. So obviously we're about to go into the last part of a multi-part story, so it is more difficult than some of the stories we've covered, I think.
Yeah.
You know, most of these 25th anniversaries that we've covered have either been the first part of a multi-part story, or like a very traditional one-off story. So the beginning, middle and end within the story, there's subplots going through it in the way that comics do, in that very soap opera way. But it's very much its own story.
Yeah.
And this very clearly is the ending of a story.
Yeah.
And I think that does affect how it comes out.
Yes.
And I think it'll affect our review at the end.
It will.
But it's the end of a story where the original Marvel superhero, Namor the Submariner. I can't say that. Submariner.
Submariner.
Submariner. Some people say Submariner, but I think it's meant to be Submariner.
It is in English.
Yes. Yes, but, you know, people only read it written down. And it, apparently it's called Namor because that's Roman spelled backwards. That was where they got the idea from. The guy who created it, Bill Everett. He's teamed up with the Canadian super team, who are called Alpha Flight, to deal with the transformation of the aquatic alien Mariner. No, Marina.
Marina.
He's Mariner, she's Marina.
Yes.
Mariner, Marina. Namor, Marina. I'm going to get that wrong many times, aren't I, reading this?
Okay. But anyway, so...
Yeah, shall I go over the story?
Yeah.
So the story is called Love. I was just going to go over the credits again. It's written by Bill Mantlo. Great writer. Penciled by Dave Ross, who was given the job apparently because he is Canadian.
Oh, okay.
Inked by Wiles Portasio, who again was someone who went on to be much more famous later.
Okay.
Lettered by Jim Novak, coloured by Bob Sharon, edited by Karl Potts, with a cover by June Brigman, Kevin Nolan and George Roussos. And the story is called Love.
Marina, strange enchantments that start whenever you're near. Marina, Aquamarina, why can't you whisper the words that my heart is longing to hear?
Namor, the submariner, calls for Marina as the Alpha Flight team swim up behind and recap the previous few issues in their thought balloons.
They do.
They really do.
They really do.
Vindicator, the leader, wonders if she should have agreed to join with Namor and the Avengers to invade Atlantis to overthrow the warlord Atuma and free Mariner. That's quite complicated, isn't it?
Yeah.
So basically, over the last few issues, Alpha Flight had teamed up with the Avengers because at that point, Namor had been an Avenger, but he was leaving the Avengers. And they'd gone to invade Atlantis, which he used to be the king of, mm-hmm. or the prince at least. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to free Marina, who was being held captive. When they freed her, Marina swam away because she was ashamed of her physical transformation. Since then, the Alphans had been searching for her. They also have time to all remember their own problems and recap their relationship dramas. So we see lots, there's about four pages at the beginning of the story where they just all remember what's going on in their own lives. All their little problems.
Yeah.
We cut to Marina remembering her backstory.
Yeah.
She's an alien Plodex and had met another of her race previously. She is worried that the fight she had with another Plodex made her pregnant and that she is about to give birth, and that's why she's changing.
So did we know that she was a Plodex?
Yes, that's in her remembering. In the story, it was about 10 issues. No, it was more than 10 issues, maybe 20 issues before.
Okay.
She'd met another alien who'd come to Earth looking for her, one of these alien Plodexes.
Okay.
Who wanted to, breed with her or something.
Okay.
And that was actually the story where she fell in love with and met Namor.
Okay. Right.
But the only member of Alpha Flight who was there was Puck.
So this is a good time, Danny. Ask, what did she look like before?
Pretty much the same without the, you know how she's got the kind of bubbles on her skin, like big boils?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those weren't there, so she looked like a human person. So, the original picture, that's kind of her before. So she's she looks a bit like an anime character, but a pretty anime character. And then they make her more monstrous, so she's got, pointy teeth and stuff.
Oh, okay.
So she's scared that this change is because the Plodex made her pregnant, that she's about to give birth. Therefore, she is trying to escape Namor, but he doesn't care. He still loves her. So he's fallen in love with her and wants to. So Alpha Flight debate whether they can allow Marina to give birth to alien children who are genetically predisposed to destroy humanity. So that was the idea. That's in the first story, it's in the recap.
Yeah.
That these aliens were sent to Earth, were sent to lots of different planets as eggs.
Yeah.
And she was one egg. And what they were meant to do was kind of find out about that culture, assimilate, and then kill everyone.
Yeah.
That's the point of these creatures, the Plodex. So yeah, they're trying to decide it before... But before they can make a decision about whether or not they can allow that to happen, Mariner's mate arrives, so the alien creature arrives. Alpha, Flight and Namor attack the monstrous Plodex, whilst Mariner feels pulled between her biological imperative and the love she has received from humanity. She comes to a decision and shouts, "I am no alien! I am Mariner! Of Earth." Instantly, her body transformed back to its normal look. She wasn't actually pregnant. She was just transformed, as she was in a state of what they call breeder receptivity. Alpha Flight, Namor and Marina quickly team up to rip apart the Plodex, and Namor and Marina are reunited. They return to Atlantis, where Namor and Marina are instantly accepted by the Atlanteans, who stage a state wedding for Namor and Marina, as the Alphans look on in shock. And that's the end.
Ariel, listen to me. The human world, it's a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything they got up there. The seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just look at the world around you. right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more are you looking for? Under the sea, under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While we devoting full time to floating under the sea.
So actually, what you can see from that review is very little actually happens in this story.
Yes.
Most of what happens is flashbacks and descriptions of what's happened before. But the actual story is they're looking for Marina. They find Marina. She gets away again.
It could have been
the Plodex catches up with them. They try to stop it. Then the two come together. She goes, actually, I don't feel like an alien. I'm a human. And then, you know, that rejects the Plodex. They kill it.
Yeah.
Quite horrifically, actually, if you think about
they
it.
They do. They do.
And then they go back to Atlantis and they get married. The end. So it's an odd little story, actually. Now, we like to talk about these stories.
We do.
To find out stuff about them. We talk about different things to do with them and score them out of five each. We give 5 points each. So the first thing I always talk about is accessibility. How easy is this for you as somebody who has not read Alpha Flight stories before?
Not very. Yeah, no, I think... And I don't really know why in this one they've decided to do a whole load of explanations. Because presumably...
For me, those explanations are very stylistic of the 80s. We've seen it in other comics that we've read. You know, this era, the X Factor that we read by Louis Simonson was very like this. And it's something I particularly myself associate with Bill Mantlo's Alpha Flight. I would say a good quarter of every issue is somebody in their mind, usually actually Vindicator, the leader, recapping the last few issues in her mind.
So is that because they expect people not to have bought the last few issues?
Well, I mean, the what they always used to say, and it was a very famous kind of saying within the comics, is that every issue could be someone's first issue.
Right.
So you want to explain anything in case. And I think as well, you know, from an earlier era, and this happened to me to some extent in this era, as a fan, there was that expectation that comics were being read from newsstands, or news agents, it would be in this country. So people would go in and they wouldn't always have a consistent access.
True.
So you get one issue, then you might miss an issue, then you get another issue, then you might get the next three issues, then you miss an issue. You know, it was difficult to guarantee that you would get every issue.
Yeah.
You know, unless you were the first person in the newsagents every day.
Because I think without the, you know, the preamble, there's very little story, really.
Yeah, very little happens of itself in this. Basically, you have the philosophical discussion.
Yeah.
Could they basically kill Marina's baby? Because they think Marina's pregnant.
Yeah.
They think her babies are going to try and destroy the Earth because they're genetically predisposed to do that. Now, so there was a thing in the original story. You know that story I talked about where Marina met the alien before and met Namor and Puck was there? There was a whole thing about the reason she looked humanoid is the egg was found by a human who touched it and it took on the DNA and, like, made her humanoid, and she took that on, and then she was brought up. So she was brought up in Canada. She's not a... She's not... it's a bit like the Superman story, I suppose.
Yeah. That's
you know, it's the alien that lands effectively as a baby, but this is a younger baby. You know, it's as a embryo, really, she lands. And imprints upon humans and becomes human for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
The difference from the Superman story is it's an alien race that normally wouldn't look like humans. You know, the Kryptonians in Superman, they all look like human beings. So, you know, it's... Superman looks human because it just happens his entire planet does, whereas hers doesn't.
So So would she have looked like that?
She'd have been all tentacles and stuff. Oh, would she? You know, okay, and they do stories at different points later on, where she turns into a sea serpent, and lots of different things are done with her. You know, she's a metamorph. She can change how she looks, as well as how she is. But I think, so the whole thing is, there's that philosophical discussion, then there's a fight. She rejects it. That's the story, effectively.
Yeah.
You know, across the whole story, there's a bit more. Because there was the whole thing about rescuing her from Atlantis.
Yeah.
There was a team up with the Avengers. There was the fact that this was the story that allowed Namor to come out of the Avengers. So they did this thing where they put him in the Avengers briefly. And it was really the storyline within the Avengers is he's someone who's never been in a team and now he's in a team. And he doesn't really belong in the team. He's more of a solo character. And that was actually the storyline within Avengers. And then he just kind of leaves to follow Marina. And they do bring him back with her, and then she's the villain, and then he leaves again. And they do lots of things over the years. He comes and goes from the Avengers a lot. They put him into X-Men at some point.
So do we think that the end is a bit of a cop-out?
I think... Yes and no. I think
it would have been more interesting if she had alien babies or they killed
possibly
her.
But then that would have elongated the story because then they would have to then do a story about the alien babies. And actually later on there are alien babies and I haven't read all the stories with them, but I think the idea was the alien babies that came later were half hers and half Namor's.
Right. So, yeah, it's quite an interesting...
She lays eggs while she's a sea serpent. I don't know. Don't ask me to explain continuity.
So the philosophical argument is a bit of a...
It's less there, a later date. They let it go.
But even that, here, it's a bit of a non...
I mean, there is an interesting thing with the Bill Mantlo run of Alpha Flight, which I quite like. It starts, so I think it's about issue 28, 29 he takes over. So this is issue 40. He's been writing it for about a year. He's on a second penciler, but, you know, he's been writing it for about a year. And he's doing this story, and the whole thing comes to a head at issue 50. So this is issue 40, and at issue 50 it all comes to a head. And effectively what he does is he destroys the team. It's something a lot of people have done in stories. So one at a time, the members of Alpha Flight get picked off and they're no longer members of Alpha Flight.
Okay.
So this is Marina going, you know, Sasquatch had actually gone before. There's a flashback thing with Walter Langowski, who's Sasquatch when he's a human. He's already been written out. They're getting rid of Marina now. There's other characters are going to go. They already got rid of Talisman, who was a character. Although she's going to pop back in and then go again immediately after this. And they're slowly writing the characters out and you end up where effectively there's just three characters in issue 50 and then he starts building it up again. So that's the way he does the team. Okay. And it's quite a common way of doing a team story. You pick them off, they all go off their own separate ways, you bring in new characters. And I think particularly with Alpha Flight, it's a really odd book. So Alpha Flight were actually created as villains for an X-Men story.
Okay.
And in the story, they're the team that Wolverine was in before he came to America. Because Wolverine's Canadian. Do you know that?
Oh, I think I did.
Yeah. So Wolverine was in Alpha Flight. He left Alpha Flight. Alpha Flight come to hunt him down. And that's, it's two issues for the X-Men. Like, back in the very late 70s, early 80s. Wolverine is
a Canadian animal.
Yes. So he's like a big character. Because they're big X-Men characters, and they were created by John Byrne, who we've mentioned before, but hadn't actually written or drawn any of the comics we've done. But he left X-Men, and he went to Fantastic Four. And we talked about him coming off Fantastic Four and being replaced. But while he was on there, they kept saying, we want you to do an Alpha Flight book. Because fans wanted an Alpha Flight book.
Right.
They thought the characters were interesting. And the interesting thing is, if you read interviews, he was kind of like, well, I didn't think the characters were interesting. I just created them to be able to survive a fight with the X-Men. And I didn't create them to be interesting in their own way. So he writes it for like the first 29 issues or so, until Bill Mantlo takes over. But you can tell he doesn't love the team. And they're almost not a team at all. So they start off all together, they all split up, they come back together. And Bill Mantlo is effectively doing the same thing. He's breaking up the team, building it up again, and putting his own characters in, because these characters don't make sense as a team.
Sure.
In a team story, usually they're all together for good reasons. And the only reason they've got for being together really is that they're all Canadian. So I think that's what he's doing here, and that makes sense. And if you read it long form, if you read issue, whatever it is, 28, 29, to issue 50, it's one story. And it makes sense. But I think maybe an individual issue with that loses some value from that. So you've got the positive and negative. You've got the positive of they explain everything that's happened, which is helpful if you've never seen an issue before. But I don't think... I think you could be right that not enough happens in that one issue to make it satisfying by itself. Do you get what I mean? We were talking about accessibility. You know, in some ways it's very accessible that it explains everything. You know, it does say this happened before, this happened before, this, this. It's even as far as, you know, my sister Aurora, she was going out with this man, he died, she's now going out with this man, but... is she going out with him for the wrong reasons because she doesn't like the idea of being alone? It's almost too much explanation.
Yeah, totally.
But I suppose if we're saying it's accessible, can it be accessible and not feel like a complete story, but you can understand everything that happens? Or do we have to mark it down for accessibility because though you understand who all the characters are if you read all the words, the fact that you have to read all those words, which are very involved and very long-winded, do we score it down for accessibility? What do you think?
I would give it...
We normally score it out of four, out of five, sorry.
We give it a three, really.
Okay.
I think for me, it's kind of... I wanted the explanations, possibly, but I also wanted story.
I gave it a 4 out of 5. So overall that's 7 out of 10. I think it does explain everything. It does, it works on its own terms.
Yeah.
And I think you can work out what's going on if you haven't read an issue. Now this is an odd one. I mean, the reason I chose this era for us to do for Should I Love This Era is because this was the first month that I bought a lot of comic books. But this was not my first issue of Alpha Flight.
Okay.
I missed this one. And my first issue of Alpha Flight was issue 42. And then I picked up some back issues.
How many issues later. Two issues back.
So, you know, I didn't read this at the time and I didn't fall in love because of this. The way I read it is I read issue 42. Then I picked up some old issues which I found on a market stall. So I read issue 42, then I think I read 37 or 38. So literally the order I read it is I read the story that takes place after this. Then I read the story that leads up to this. And then I read the newer stories. So I read this the wrong way around. And I was able to do that. I knew what had happened. I knew Marina had left. I knew because it was recap. But I never read this as by itself. I always read it in context of later stories, but also in context of earlier stories. So maybe I'm being too generous, but I gave it a 4 out of 5. Okay. You've given it a 3 out of 5, so that's 7 out of 10.
Good.
For accessibility. So the next thing we score is artwork. What did you think for the interior artwork?
The interior artwork?
Not the cover.
Clean. Clean is my...
It's very clean. In some ways, I mean, what Dave Ross is best at is texture, actually.
Mm. Yeah.
And kind of 3D-ness, I would say, as a penciler.
Mm.
But whilst Portasio, at this point in time, was inking in a very clean style, and he was very influenced, whilst Portasio is Filipino, but okay. He was very influenced, I think, by, and this was starting to come through in the late 80s, he was one of the artists who was influenced by the kind of Japanese comics, the manga,
okay.
The anime. You can see that, a little bit of that influence coming through.
Yeah.
And that influence, you know, going with this very kind of old school, you know, I think the characters as drawn by Dave Ross always have a real solidity. You can feel them in context. Yeah. And actually one thing I think this issue does very well is it deals with water very well.
Yes.
You know, the entire story takes place underwater. And actually the use of shadow and the use of, you know, plants and even colour, which is down to the colourist, obviously, not the artist. But I think that, I mean, look at the solidity of Namor there and the 3D-ness of his body.
Yeah.
That was something that Dave Ross has always been great at and still is. He's still a working comics artist today.
The interesting in the interesting page 6, the top of the page, is that, like, actually his feet, has like, he's chosen to not have his feet in the frame.
Yeah, yeah, they're not always. And then there's other panels where it's just his feet.
Yeah, so...
But I think there's a confidence in Dave Ross's work that he can draw people really well.
Movement,
yeah. And they've got heft and they've got, he's good at perspective and he can show swimming and it looks a bit like swimming.
Mm.
I mean, there is an element where they look like they're flying through the water as well, like they're always in comics. But I think the people feel real, so the stuff he does works really well. Yeah. So what score out of 5 are you giving the art?
I liked the art. Sometimes I have difficulty with, in comics anyway, with kind of trying... like an old art, like an old painting, so you know, sort of, the expressions and what the expressions are trying to convey.
Mm.
And I think he's very good at page 8, for example, top right. Mm. There's a picture of Marina, and so, you know, and you get the anguish.
Yeah, definitely. He does communicate characterization very well, I think.
Sort of like
I think that's something that Paul Smith? He's not Paul Smith. Dave Ross is particularly good at.
Very good at the kind of, you know, the kind of... And on page 9, so, you know, her looking at her body and being disgusted and sort of, you know... I tell you what, there's a frame on page 9 that looks a bit like... What was that comic one? The comic that we did that was all oldie... that was Romeo and Juliet, but with...
Oh, the Dr. Fate. Yeah, there's a certain cartoony... I mean, Marina's design, even as drawn by John Byrne, who was a very traditional comics artist, she was designed as kind of a Japanese manga character within... Okay. A more kind of realistic world.
That's interesting.
She always had that look. And I presume that was an influence of what was going on in... You know, it was really coming to the fore. I think Americans and British people, obviously, were starting to get Japanese comics more so. This is 86, but, I mean, don't forget the character. I think the character first appeared in issue 1. She's not one of the characters who goes back to the X-Men. She first appeared, I think, in... Issue 1 or 2 of Alpha Flight.
I certainly remember the beginning of the 90s.
So you would talk about 1983 or so. And you can imagine people who are professionally involved in comics were probably ahead of the wave in knowing about Japanese animation.
And by the beginning of the 90s, you know, people like my cousins and stuff were hugely influenced by manga.
It was a huge thing.
I wasn't particularly, but...
You know, it was a huge cultural force. And I think particularly, you know, part of the thing of, you know, an artist like Wiles Portasio, who's American, but he's Filipino, and he's the inker, and he's bringing in that influence from Filipino art, And then, you know, for quite a while, from the mid-70s, there really was that Filipino influence on.
And you can tell, sort of, like, I think even within the fight scene, although it's a bit messy, the fight scene. I mean, it's interesting that within the frame that's the fight scene, sort of, like, it has to tell you what's happening.
I mean, the other thing is the whole fight scene happened in one panel.
Yeah.
Which, again, so, probably shows that too much space is taken up by other stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe.
But then I think that's down to writing, not art.
Okay. Yeah. No.
But, you know, me personally, I scored the art 5 out of 5. I don't know what you would do.
I would give it 4 out of 5.
It's usually you're the more generous one than me. It's, we've swapped places this week.
Yeah.
So that gives us 9 out of 10 for artwork.
Yeah.
So the next one, characterization.
Yeah.
That's the next one that we score out of 5. How did you feel the characters came across? Do you feel like you know all the characters in there? If I was to name all the characters in that comic, could you tell me something about them?
No.
No. And I think this is a weaker era of this. I think some of it is as simple as Bill Mantlo is a big fan of, like, that kind of classic melodrama. We've talked about this a lot within these comics of that era.
Mm.
There was a real tendency towards the big, you know, operatic or soap operatic, you know, caricature of characters. And ultimately, even though it tells you things about what's happened in the past, the only people who really have characterization in this issue, I would say, are Namor, Marina, and possibly Vindicator as the leader.
Yeah, yeah.
But even then, it's just, she's like, oh, did I do the right thing?
Yeah.
By doing this, which I'm now going to tell you about in my thought bubble, so you know what I did.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit about the relationship between North Star and Aurora, and he's worried about his sister.
Yeah.
There's like a touch of the stuff with Roger Box and Aurora having a relationship, and, you know, that both of them doubt it in various ways. But
maybe,
you know,
it's all a bit dropped, and then
it's in there, about, but I don't think, yeah.
Thought about, but not.
It's not acted upon. The characterization is within people's heads, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there are other stories within this run where it's much more on the page. It's much more how the characters interact.
But apart from, I didn't think that the drawing of the characters were very strong. I didn't have immediate recognition apart from the whale and, you know, the boy in the robot, or the man in the robot.
I mean, everyone's just kind of there, aren't they? So, characterisation, I scored, I did score it at 3, because I thought there was some characterisation.
Yeah.
And everyone's consistent.
Yeah.
And actually, they're consistent with previous and later stories as well, if you've read previous and later stories, which you haven't.
Yeah.
But everyone's consistent. Everyone acts how you would expect that character to act.
Mm.
Nobody is acting out of character.
Mm. Mm.
But you don't really know who all the characters are. And actually, I would argue, like Snowbird, who was the whale, if you didn't very carefully read the flashbacks in thought bubbles, you wouldn't even know that was a character. You'd just know that for some reason there is
a random
whale. A person of short stature sat on the back of a whale with a spear in his hand.
Oh, okay.
You wouldn't know that the whale was a transformed member of the team.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you definitely don't know. You don't get any of the things behind it. I mean, you do find out that Roger Box is an amputee.
Yeah.
But you don't get the stuff about, you know, some of it, which is very ridiculous and over the top. But the thing where Aurora is a multiple personality, that North Star is gay, but they never say gay on panel, but everybody knows.
Yeah.
They do discuss it in the letters page, so everybody knows.
Oh, okay.
You know, I don't think you really know who most of the characters are. So I went 3 out of 5, which maybe was a bit generous considering that. Yeah. What would you go for?
I'd probably give it the same.
3 out of 5?
2, 3, yeah.
So that gives us 6 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
for characterization. So the next one is cover.
Yes.
So the cover, June Brinkman, Kevin Nolan.
Yeah.
George Russo's obviously the border done by John Romita Sr., as we've said before.
Yeah.
I like this cover. Do you like this cover?
I do. Yeah.
I think it's very interesting. It's the only one. The covers this month are all face shots of one character.
Mm.
And the clever thing they do, and it's the only one of these covers that attempts it, is they get all the other characters into it because she wears mirrored sunglasses, Vindicator, the leader of the team.
She does.
So you've got a close-up picture of her with all her colleagues reflected in the sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fabulous. I think that works really well.
Yeah, no, it's clever.
I think the actual stylization of the drawing, which a lot of that comes from Kevin Nolan, who's the inker, he's got a very, very specific style. And he's really, really simplified what June Brinkman does.
There's her hair at the back.
Yeah, that's her hair going off, because she's the one with the ponytail coming out of her helmet.
Oh, okay. That,
you know, there's a ponytail at the top. And that's that, it's part red, part white, because it's the costume is based around the Canadian flag. So if you look at it inside, let me find a good picture of it inside to show you when you get to see her properly. But there is, yeah, it's like partly red, partly...
No,
actually, no, that's just a shadow, that is. It shouldn't be coloured red.
No.
You're right, there's a colour error on that. Oh, I feel bad now, because I gave that 5 out of 5, that cover, and there's a colouring error. Is maybe I should score it down, because it's coloured red there.
Oh, okay.
And that should be white, shouldn't it?
I don't know, I couldn't see what...
Yeah, internally, all the time, her helmet's white.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's shining from something else. But...
yeah, it's a reflection. I'll let it go.
Okay.
But I like the fact you've got all the characters there. I like the way they're drawn.
The blue sets it off quite well at the background.
Yeah, and also fits with the story where they're underwater.
Mm.
I like the fact that she's coming in at an angle, which gives it a bit more movement. Yeah, I mean...
it's fluid. It's kind
of... I mean, Kevin Nolan really does. He's a very... hopefully we'll do a story drawn by him at some point. Mm. I will have to do one for this anyway, because he's one of my favourite comics artists.
Mm.
And he's an absolute genius. And even when he's just inking someone else, he really adds so much to the look of the art.
Mm. Mm.
June Brinkman's art tends to be a bit more kind of classic comics.
Mm.
Mm. And actually what she does mainly now is she does comic strips. Like story comic strips in American newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's got that very clean, very naturalistic art style. And he gives her a lot of character.
Mm.
That maybe is... I mean, her stuff is amazing, but he really adds character. I think he looks amazing. Mm. And the logo's amazing.
The logo's very...
I do like that logo.
The logo is very 80s.
It is very 80s, but I think it works very well.
It kind of reminds me of... Daryl and... what was that other film called? Voyage of the... I want to say Voyage of the Dawn Treader, but no.
You talk about Flight of the Navigator?
Yeah.
I've got the comics adaptation of that.
Of course you do.
It's not that good, so no. We're probably not going to cover it on this, but it exists.
Only because it was on over Christmas that I started watching it and I thought, this is shit. It's sort of like, and nobody remembers Daryl, so
no, I don't remember. When you said Daryl, I was thinking of my half brother, which obviously
no Daryl,
you probably not. They didn't make a film, but it's an acronym, isn't it? It's like Daryl or whatever it is,
and it's about a boy who's a robot.
Yeah. But no, that I think, yeah, that typeface is very kind of 80s futurism.
Yeah, no, I like that.
But I think it works really well, actually.
I would have that on the wall.
Would you? You like that cover. So yeah. What are you giving it? I gave it a 5 out of 5.
I would give it a 5 out of 5 as well.
So we're going 10 out of 10 on cover.
Gosh.
That's very good. That's
very us.
So we've done all the positive stuff. We always do that first, and then we take away points at the end for what was acceptable in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So the question becomes, is there anything in this that was acceptable in the 80s that wouldn't be acceptable now? Is it problematic in any way that maybe wouldn't have registered in 1986 but would now? Or maybe should have registered in 1986.
Yeah, what I was thinking was the she could, warty lady.
Marina?
Yeah, Marina, that'll be the... She was a bit passive.
Yes. I mean, she is quite passive in the story. Things are happening to her.
To her.
But then I suppose the kind of end of the story is her going, no, I'm my own person and I'm who I am.
But she doesn't.
I'm not what you say I am. So in a way...
Yeah, you can argue
it's
that.
It's rejecting the passivity. Passivity? I don't know quite how you say that. That's a word I think I've only ever written, not said. The passiveness. But she's kind of rejecting other people deciding what she is.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's in some ways, it's a very modern story that it's a woman going, I'm not what you say I am, I am what I believe I am. You know, as many, many modern...
She didn't kill the monster, though.
She didn't kill the monster, the others did. I mean, there is a question about killing the monster as well, because... The monster is not presented as having his own thoughts and feelings. He's just a monster. But he is the same kind of being as Marina, who has got her own thoughts and feelings.
And there's kind of, you know, that male thing of, you know, that traditional male, you know, stereotype of only wanting to breed, which I suppose is...
Yeah, it could be seen as toxic. I mean, to be honest, the toxic stuff for me in here, I think there's some attempts at inclusivity. I think they try and do good things. And some of them are in there quite early in Alpha Flight. You know, the fact that North Star was intended to be gay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, it's not a big part of this story, but it's in there and it's in the characterisation. And Bill Mantlo was writing it knowing that fans knew that he was meant to be gay. Because it was discussed in, you know, magazines, it was in interviews, in the letters column later on. But, you know, they don't do it on panel of him saying, I am gay, until a story in the 90s, I think about 1993.
And what do you think?
But I think the fact that they wrote a story about, with a gay character in it in 1986, you have to give some points for that.
Yes.
Although this is about taking points away. So I think there's that attempt. I think there's an attempt with, you know, one of the characters an amputee.
Yeah.
You know, and it's quite a stereotyped view of an amputee.
Yeah.
It's part of my problem with this story is I can't read it without knowing what happens next. Because I've read
But then I think that what they do, because that's Box who's an amputee, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what they do is they're quite positive about his box, his kind of machines, which I think is quite or at least they don't comment on it. For listeners who are new to this podcast, I'm a wheelchair user. The wheelchair is a positive thing because it lets me, it helps me. But for a lot of people, a wheelchair isn't a positive thing, and his adaptations are a positive thing.
The fact that he's using a robot as his adaptation that was designed by his friend, Mr. Jeffries, who's one of the characters. All of that seems very positive. Obviously, unfortunately, and this is the problem of looking back on something.
Oh dear.
I know what happens next in the story. So next in the story...
Electrocuted by his own machine.
Well, the first issue I read, I said, was a couple of issues later.
Okay.
And he's going crazy.
Okay.
And he's attacking Marina.
Oh, dear.
Not Marina, Aurora.
Aurora.
Who's his girlfriend, because she's going off the idea of being with him.
Oh, okay.
Because there's a thing in this story that's mentioned.
Yeah.
He's trapped in the robot because he gets the bends.
Yeah.
You know, when he's underwater,
he
gets pressure sickness and he can't come out of the robot. So he's always a robot.
So she's like,
I can't be in love with a robot. I need a man.
Yeah.
You know, and she was fine with him as an amputee, but the trapped in a robot. And then he goes crazy.
Yeah.
and they kind of get past this, but he's then there's a supervillain who can change people's bodies.
Mm, mm.
And quite a lot of this storyline in many ways is the whole storyline that Bill Mantlo does is body horror. There's a lot of body horror in
yeah.
it. And
yeah.
there's this character called Scrambler who can change people's bodies.
Okay.
And he actually grows a perfected body for Roger Box. So Box ends up in a perfect body. I'm right. doing air quotes here, which you can't actually see on no. the podcast. But he ends up in a perfect body, and he'll finally be able to right. love
yeah, that's probably
Aurora.
But within the confines of this...
And then within that, he then goes crazy again.
Mm.
And then... And some of this is down to the person, and there's a whole thing with the villain. Mm. But basically, he attacks everyone again. Yeah. She rejects him in the perfect body.
Mm.
And then he is usurped from his power.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jeffries takes over the Box robot. So his friend
right.
takes over his role, and the disabled man becomes the villain.
Okay.
You know, and also the fact that he's disabled because he's a Vietnam veteran.
Right.
There's a lot of stereotypes within there.
Okay.
You know, there is positivity within the story. Yeah. The idea of the character, the idea that there's this man who's slightly overweight, he's an amputee, he uses a wheelchair,
mm.
and he does use a normal wheelchair.
Right.
As well as the robot.
Oh, okay.
So he phases into the robot from his wheelchair.
Okay.
He kind of jumps out of his wheelchair and phases right. into the robot. Okay. And then when he comes out of it, he jumps into the wheelchair.
Okay.
And, you know, he's shown having a normal relationship with
yeah.
a woman.
Yeah.
Admittedly, a woman with mental health difficulties, okay. questionable things could be raised.
Okay.
But the fact that I know they're going to turn him into a villain
yeah,
makes the positivity. So I think there is positivity. There's attempts at inclusivity. You know,
do we?
North Star is gay, but it's not on the page. Yeah.
Do we? But I suppose we have to decide if we just look at this.
I think we have to just look at this, but I think we have to consider... I think the issue you get here... is they're trying to be inclusive, but they're muddling it a bit.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and that's not surprising. It's 1986. Mm, it's written by a straight white man.
Mm, mm.
You know, it's edited by a straight, actually not white man, but a straight mixed heritage man.
Yeah, yeah.
Karl Potts was part Japanese.
Okay.
His mother was Japanese. You know, it's drawn by a straight white man.
So
it's inked yeah. by a man who's Filipino, but... So it's more mixed than some comics. And it's going in the right direction, and they're trying to be inclusive. But it's this thing where if there was anyone disabled involved, I think, well, maybe not in 1986. Maybe even if the person had been there in 1986. I don't think anyone, nowadays, somebody would put their hand up and go, you can't make the disabled guy the villain again.
Yeah.
You know, people know that that's a really dangerous trope now.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it still happens in stories, but hopefully there's someone in the room with enough wherewithal or enough connection to be going, no, don't do that.
Mm. But then I think also what was interesting was the sort of, I was asking myself what makes it Canadian. So I was wondering, so, you know, apart from the shapeshifter, the kind of sort of like, I think there's one sort of, you know, there's one panel where they kind of say, well, we're not like Americans or we don't kill people.
This is not a good issue for showing it as being Canadian.
Yeah, okay.
Because number one, they're under the water.
Okay.
Which doesn't really be Canadian or not Canadian. Okay. You know, that is part of it.
Yeah.
But also a lot, because this story is really about Namor and Marina.
Mm.
You lose a lot of the Canadianness of it.
Okay.
You know, you lose the fact, I mean, in some ways, in a good way, Aurora and North Star, the brother and sister, are Quebeci.
Okay.
And they're French Canadian.
Quebecois.
Quebecois, is that what you say? Quebecois. You see, I didn't even know that. I've seen it written down.
I've met some Quebecois.
Yes. Well, you're French. You know, normally they have like really exaggerated French accents.
Mm.
And their real names are Jean-Paul and Jean-Marie.
Yeah, well, there you go.
There you go.
Jean-Jean. My father called Jean-Philippe.
Okay. Exactly, they all exist. There's you know, you've got that. Mm. Snowbird has almost disappeared in this. She's just turned into a whale.
Mm.
But she comes from kind of ancient she's the child of a goddess from
right.
the kind of native... Do you say Native Canadian, or are they still called Native Americans? Because you're talking about the continent.
Indigenous
Canadians. But from that, you know, that it's taken from there.
Mm.
The character, her parents in the story, well, her father's a human, but her mother is an actual goddess within that.
Right.
Kind of, it's a bit like, you know...
Yeah, yeah.
Her mother is like the equivalent of a Thor or whatever. You know, I suppose in this country it'd be like if her mother was Guinevere.
Okay.
Maybe not quite that, because that's less of a goddess. But you know what I mean, a legendary figure.
Yeah.
Obviously, I think, as well, there's Shaman, who's one of the characters, and Talisman, his daughter, they are indigenous peoples as well. And they are... the fact that they're the magic characters, I think, could be considered reductionist. You know, that you make your native characters a magical because they connect to that. I mean, there's things within the characters that mix that up.
Yeah.
You know, Shaman is a magical character, but he's also a doctor in his real life.
Okay.
You know, his daughter is a magical character, Talisman. But she's also an archaeologist. So they do things that are separate from their background. You know, there is, it's better than some. Mm. You know, there's obviously, we've had other stories where there have been native characters who are just that. That is their whole character. I am the native character. I am the indigenous person. Which can be problematic.
Yeah.
But you know, this attempt, they're attempting to be more modern. They're attempting to be more inclusive. They're attempting to reflect Canada, also reflect human experience. So you've got a character who is, they describe as a dwarf.
Okay.
A character with dwarfism. I mean, it does turn out in a story that was about 10 issues before that he's a dwarf because of magic and he was actually normal size, which again is problematic.
Yeah,
I think you could argue it would be better if there was just a character who happened to be a dwarf who was also an adventurer.
Yeah.
And when he was introduced, that's how he seemed. He was like an acrobat and a dwarf. Okay. And he fought people and he was as effective as a person who wasn't.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of give and take here. They're attempting to be inclusive. They've got gays, they've got people with mental illness, they've got physically
disabled
people, they've got mentally disabled people, they've got native characters or indigenous characters, they're trying to reflect what Canada is historically and in the modern day. I think this particular issue, I gave it a -1 because I think you have to take something off just for the costume that Shaman wears. And even though he doesn't really do anything in this issue. But just the fact that that exists, I feel like I have to take something off for that.
Okay.
Because I think it's too stereotypical.
Yeah.
I think across the whole series, there's more that you could criticise. I think, you know, the way they deal with North Star, particularly in the run-up to issue 50, they start a plot where he appears to be showing signs of age.
Oh, okay.
Which they then backtrack on. In fact, that's something that was approved by Jim Shooter, and when Jim Shooter went, they went, no, you can't have your character have AIDS, and they changed the story.
Right.
But that was clearly what it was leading to. Mm. Now, that, I think, was an error. You know, it might have seemed like a good thing to do in 1986.
Yeah.
But actually, I think, to just go, oh, well, we've got one gay character in the entire Marvel Universe, let's give him AIDS.
Yeah.
You know, we've got one amputee. Actually, they haven't. They've got a lot of people with amputated arms.
Yeah.
One with an amputated, double amputee of his legs.
Right.
Who needs to use a wheelchair. We'll make him the villain.
Yeah.
You know, I think errors happen, but they don't happen in this issue.
Mm,
So I feel like I can't take the points off for that, even though it's all colouring in my head. Which I think is the thing about reading out of order as well, that this wasn't the first Alpha Flight I read. What would you have taken anything off if I'd not told you all that stuff? that's maybe not as obvious in here.
I don't think there was anything that screamed.
So if I'm taking off one and you're taking off nothing, we're only taking off one point between us.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. I don't think there was anything that was particularly screaming at me, oh my gosh.
I mean, it's definitely not... There's nothing... You know, we've had issues before that we've covered that have had racially insensitive names, that have been incredibly sexist, that have been, you know... I mean, we had a dwarf villain before. This isn't the first dwarf we've had. So, you know, it's a lot better, and it's trying to be even better than it is, I think. I think Bill Mantlow was always trying... I think some people talk about Bill Mantlow. He's never considered one of the greatest writers. I think he was a very good comics writer, and I think he's better than he gets credited for being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? I think he's more creative. He created some fantastic characters. I think he did some good work. You know, we loved that Spider-Man story he did with Cloak and Dagger that we reviewed before, which wasn't within this series, but, back in the past. I think he was a very good writer who was very underrated. But he was always trying to do... I think one of the reasons he's underrated is he would quite often fail because he was trying to be a better writer than he was capable of being. But I would rather that a writer tries to do great work and misses the mark than they go, oh, well, I'm just some schlub who's a good enough writer but not the best. So I'm not going to even try. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm being too unfair on him to how some other people see it, but yeah, I feel like he was always aiming high. So I'm just going to add up what scores we've given this. What's that? 16 plus 6 is 24. Plus 10 is 34. Minus 1 is 33. So guess what? This is the highest score we've had.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I think it is because, in many ways, it's the least offensive that we've had. You know, a lot of these that we've scored, we've had to take up a lot for acceptable in the
80s. Yeah.
So where they've been good, they've had errors on that kind of stuff. You know, either politically, I mean, there was all the IRA stuff in the web issue. But yeah, it's in the lead. It's 33 out of 40 for Alpha Flight 40. And number two was Daredevil, which got 31.5, so only slightly below. That was an incredibly well-drawn story in particular. Really beautifully drawn, really good story. Then behind that, we had Amazing Spider-Man with 29 out of 40. Then just below that, Fantastic Four with 28 out of 40. Then Web of Spider-Man down at 23 out of 40. And the one that is my favourite personally is still our lowest score, 21.5 out of 40. For X Factor, and that ultimately is because most of the villains were incredibly racist.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly unfortunate, and probably, well, definitely I didn't notice in 1986.
Which was what?
Well, I didn't notice that those characters were racist in 1986, which I think is why I love it so much, because I read it in 1986 and loved it.
And that's always quite difficult.
You know, nowadays I read it and I'm like, oh my god. Somebody should have changed this, but they didn't, because we didn't know.
But you were only 12.
I was only 12, yes.
I was only 11.
I mean, I think the other side of that is, like, the editor, Bob Harris, and the writer, Louis Simonson, were considerably older than 12.
Yeah.
And maybe could have changed. I mean, in fairness, a lot of the offensively named characters were older characters who were coming back.
Yeah.
And possibly, you know, back then, and I think even now today, you do get an element where people complain more about you changing the name than they do about you featuring the character who's offensive. Anyway, on that bombshell of it being our highest score so far of Should I Love This Era, we're going to end this episode.
It's a good beginning to a new year.
Definitely, we've started with a strong one. It was a pretty good story. I mean, weirdly, some of the ones that we've scored lower, I said the lowest scoring one is my personal favourite, is the one that I feel most connected to. I would probably say that, I don't know, I think a lot of the other ones I consider better comics. But this is I think the secret to this one getting such a good score is it's exceptionally competent. Which sounds like an insult, but actually getting the basics right.
Yeah.
You know, clear art. Making it clear who, what's going on. Letting you know where you are in the story. It's not confusing. It's not too flashy. It's all just very, very clear and competent. Which again does sound like an insult, but that helps you fly.
No, I think you've convinced me that it's probably a better comic.
I think on a craft level, it is better than a lot of the others.
I just got a bit bogged down in.
I think it was hard work to read, and it surprised me when I was writing the script, when I was going through and writing the, not the review, but like the write-up of how the story goes, that I had to read a hell of a lot to get out very little.
I
think that was the shortest description of the story that I've ever done.
Yeah,
in one of these episodes.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking as well.
And yet, I read more words.
Yeah.
But then that gives you everything.
Felt
so if you're completely new, it does set it up. And it's less satisfying as a story than many of the others. Many of the others, I think, have a clearer beginning, middle and end.
Yeah.
They're more satisfying. But if you're being objective and just scoring on, can you understand it? Is the art good? Is the characterization? Is it does better than some of the others, which are in many ways are greater, but they've got weaknesses because maybe they're putting the overall effect ahead of individual storytelling tools.
Maybe it's
And I mean, maybe some of that's down to the fact that you have to experiment to be truly great, and you're more likely to make mistakes when you experiment. So when you get everything competent. But actually, I think a lot of this comes down to the fact, you know, at the beginning we were talking about, you know, the whole Jim Shooter thing and getting on with editors.
Sure.
This was something that Carl Potts and Bill Mantlow worked together on and created. And Carl Potts basically was in charge of this. Jim Shooter didn't touch it. And I think when chaos is going on, that's what made us lose some score on some of the others. And this was created in a very competent, very clean, clear situation. You know, it's a creative team who are set, who know what they're doing, who are just going on with the story. And we will see that in some of the other ones that we haven't done yet. There are some other series. In fact, the one that just crossed over with this, Avengers, crossed over with this in the previous issue. Their next issue, which is the next one we're going to cover, you will see a story that's unaffected by all the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Okay.
It's just a story where a good writer and a talented editor have worked together to create the story, and nobody's gone, no, you've got to change that, I'm firing that person, you've got to find someone new to write that by next week. You know, all those things that were kind of putting the others slightly lopsided or slightly out of sync. None of that was happening with this story. And I think we'll see that again with Avengers. And I'll look forward to doing that in hopefully within the month.
Yes, hopefully.
We're hoping to do this monthly. I know we had quite a big gap between the last two. But if we can get 12 out this year, I'd be really, really happy.
Yes, absolutely. And if you like this podcast...
Yeah, please tell your friends about us. As you know, you can go on to our... We have a little blog spot.
We do.
Called Should I Like This? No, Should I Love This? Blogspot.com, where I share pictures from the issue and also like details about it. You can follow us on Podbean. That's where we are. You can follow both of us on social media. We have Irrigale32 and Whiter Trash, which seemed funny when I came up with it.
They won't know how to spell Irrigale, but they can follow me from your
page. Yeah, they can get there from shouldilovethis.blogspot.com. We would love for you to put comments on that post as well.
Absolutely.
You know, we'd love to have an interaction with people who are listening. It's a very interesting time in comics that we're looking at the moment. And, you know, really hoping that it will help people find us and get interested in what we've got to say.
Yeah.
But it was great talking over another comic with you, darling. We'll do it again in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
And hopefully keep these coming out monthly from now onwards. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much and happy new year.
Oh yeah, happy new year. See you soon.
Bye.